Hey, it's John Canzano. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe. And thanks to all the listeners and all of our sponsors who help make the Bald-Faced Truth the number one sports radio show in Portland. Enjoy.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. John Canzano.
People don't like to hear the truth all the time. You know, people ask you questions, but they don't actually necessarily want to hear the answers.
Love it.
I mean, I like the guy. I listen to him every day.
Canzano, what's going on, man?
He's dead sexy.
I think he does a damn good job.
I'm going to be rooting for this young Portland team, which, you know, is a terrific team. You guys just have a terrific nucleus.
You pay attention to detail. That's why you're so successful.
I just think he's honest. Yeah. Straightforward and to the point.
You're bringing up something that's probably the average sports fan watching the game didn't pick up on.
I'm really glad to see that someone who speaks their mind is not afraid to tell it how it is.
He's a smart guy. That's my dude, man. Yeah, I know him, man.
I let my mother listen to him.
Hate him.
You don't want to give nobody a second chance.
Trump.
To represent that as some sort of subterfuge by John Canzano, I would have expected far better.
He just sounds like an egotistical idiot.
He was rude, crude, and wrong.
Love to hate
him. Yo, John, I can't stand you. I can't stand you, but I come back every day to listen to the show.
Bald faith truth teller.
Who is he to judge?
Well, he can raise your eyebrows a lot.
I was angry. He just got my feathers that day big time.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth. Welcome to a special edition of the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show.
Jim Barnett, who went to the University of Oregon, played for the Blazers, played in the NBA, now serving as an analyst for the Golden State Warriors. I'm going to ask him, like, what advice he would give. Welcome to the show, Jim. Thanks for making time.
Thank you, John. Keep me going here. I have a soft place in my heart for you guys up in Portland.
Well,
I love your town. I love the Blazers. I love the city.
The advice that you would give to high school and college graduates, what you know now that you wish somebody had told you back then, what would be on that list?
Well, we're comparing night and day from when I got out of the University of Oregon in 1966. And I'm just going to tell you a quick story if I have a little time here.
Yeah.
I was the number one draft pick of the Celtics. There were 10 teams in the league. I was the eighth pick overall. I got a call from the Boston Globe sports writer. So here's how this was still the embryonic stage of things, and no one knew who anybody was out on the West Coast. I did play in the East-West College All-Star Game, which was the biggest showcase, and that was the only showcase. And I had a good showing there because I led the West in scoring. I think that made me a first-round draft pick rather than a second round. Of course, if you were the 11th or 12th pick, that was a second round in those days.
Yeah.
So at any rate, Red Auerbach picked me. But when I talked to this sports editor from the Boston Globe, after about 10 minutes, he asked me a question. So this will tell you, put it in context. He said, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. He said, are you black or white? So they don't even know what color you are. Not that it makes a difference, but it did back in Boston. That's a whole other subject. But it's tough to compare now and then. Because we had to play 4 years of college. Even if you didn't go to college,
yeah,
you could not enter the NBA until your high school class graduated from college. So the way I feel about it is this. I think players should stay for at least 2 and 3 years is even better for a number of reasons. You're going to become a better basketball player. And I know some guys come out and they make it without going to college at all, only going 1 year. But I can give you a litany of players who never make it. We had one here a few years ago. He kicked around finally, and he would have made a lot of money had he gone to 4 years of college. Instead, he went 1 year, and he just never made it and washed out of the league. Number one, you're going to be a better basketball player. I know people say, well, what about the risk of injury? How many players have you known through the years that they ended their pro hopes by getting hurt in college? I really can't really think of any. So another thing is, you are maturing and you're getting social advantages. You're learning how to live in the world and how to integrate yourself in the world so you have a perspective. These are men you're playing with, and you're going around. You're not even old enough to go into a bar and order a beer when you come out and you're 19, 20 years old. And so I just think that for the growth of an individual socially and integrating himself into society, it benefits him. That's my take on it.
Jim Barnett, former Blazer, former Oregon Duck, now with the Warriors as a television analyst, is our guest. Hey, I'm looking back at the league standings from like 1967, and I see the 10 teams that were in the league, and Philadelphia won 68 games. How many games would these Warriors win in a 10-team league back then?
Ooh, that's a good question, because you played everybody 9 times. That was the last year they ever had a schedule of 81. You didn't really have to scout too much because you played them so often.
There you are again.
it's tough to compare eras. I will just say this. The great players of that era would be great players today, and certainly the great players in this era would be equally as great or better. I've even tweeted out that if Stephen Curry played in my era, he'd probably average 40 a game if they put a three-point line in, because he'd be used to it and know how to handle it. There were only 120 NBA players in, not 450 as there are today. And people didn't have guaranteed contracts. In fact, I played 11 years and never had a guaranteed contract. But these players today are much more athletic, John, than we ever were. I mean, they're quicker, they're stronger, they're faster. It'd be interesting to see that the older players in the era of 60s and 70s would have to make an adjustment. That's for sure. But, and I've always said this, these are better athletes today, but from the neck up, they're not comparable to the players of yesteryear because of this, only about fundamentals. They're not as sound fundamentally. I saw Andrew Bogut, in fact, against Stevie Adams, and this is a critical game six. And he started to block out, but he turned the wrong way. Stephen Adams got inside him. Instead of doing a reverse drop-step pivot, he went forward with it, and then he cut himself short. And little things like that, it surprises me, and it makes a difference. And keeping your eye on the ball. Stephen Curry got burned against Robertson one time when Stephen Adams threw like a fastball from 60 feet out, just like a major league pitcher, right by his ear because he didn't have his vision on the ball.
You mentioned the neck up. Was the player back then a more tuned in player because the competition was there? There was only 120 of you in the league, and you would get flushed out if you weren't, or was there something else going on with teaching?
Well, we were taught, and you had to learn that way. And it's interesting because I saw many a player get put on waivers, a college kid, maybe wasn't even drafted, and today he would make an NBA roster. Yeah. But in those days, he wouldn't. And it's just like Pete Maravich is a great example. Pete Maravich would be a bigger star today with the way he could handle the ball, the flair that he had for the game. But we, as players and coaches, would not allow him to play that kind of style, that style of basketball. He really only he had some good years, led the league in scoring, but he played 10 years in the league. He didn't play 12 or 14 and what have you. So we were sound fundamentally because we had to be, and you had to do that. And it was let's say it's a little more deliberate style, if you will, or something. It's hard to shift it into today's players because, as they say, they're so much more athletic. And we could do all the fundamentals and everything, be standing there, and the guy's gone by you, too.
So yeah, right.
If I tried to play today, I was extremely quick. But the way the game is played and with the team defense, and that's why when Oscar Robertson said, well, if Steph Curry hit a few shots out there, I'd go pick him up at half court. Well, I'm sorry, Oscar, but he'd go around you. And the thing is, in our era, there was no team help defense. When I drove my man and got around my man as a guard position, the only one player I had to worry about was the center. Nobody came in from the corners. Nobody came in from the wings. So I was able to finish my drives inside by beating the big man. He was the only one I worried about. And I had quickness over him. Today, they'd be sagging in. I wouldn't get the drives and be able to finish. I'd have to throw it out to the corner and out to the wings because you're going to get help. We played more team offense and individual defense. Today they play more individual offense and team defense. Now the Warriors are an exception. San Antonio, they play a lot of team offense nowadays, but still there's a lot of you see the one-on-one and the individuals rise and meet that challenge. So it's a little different, just opposite. Team defense, individual offense, and vice versa. So I will tell you this. Elvin Hayes, just a second here. Some ladies upset because I'm up at a park that I'm talking to you on the phone.
Oh, yeah. Tell her relax. She lives in a public. You're not at her house, are you?
No.
You're at a park.
Yeah. You know.
Not a library. You're at a park. Okay.
It's not a library. Yeah. It's open yeah. space. I'm up by, you know, where all the trails begin. And I was the only one up here for a while. And then all of a sudden they came up. But anyway.
Yeah.
So I was going to say this, that, now I lost my little train of thought there. About players then
team defense, player team offense, but was what you're talking about essentially Oklahoma City was sharing the ball and looking very good through the first four games of that series in the West Finals. Yep. Then they got back to save us, bail us out, Kevin Durant or Russell Westbrook, and that kind of speaks to what you were talking about.
A little bit, and that's one reason I didn't vote for Russell Westbrook to be on the first team All-NBA team, because a great player has to make those around him better. And Russell Westbrook is just like J.R. Smith, whom the Warriors are going to meet in the Cleveland series. He can shoot you into a game, but he can also just as easily shoot you out of a game. And I thought the last 5 minutes, well, first of all, he didn't score in his 12 minutes in the third quarter. He did not score at all against the Warriors in game 7 in the third quarter. And Durant, I thought, was terrific throughout. He just didn't get a lot of shots because Iguodala did a heck of a job on him preventing him getting shots. And so he shot a pretty good percentage, though. And this was a four-point game and in the last couple of minutes, and Kevin Durant came down and took a quick three. I didn't question the shot at all. If that had gone in, it would have been a one-point game. So I can't fault him for that. I'm going to, you know, give credit to the Warriors for winning that series. But I'm also going to give credit for OKC in games 3 and 4 when they just absolutely destroyed the Warriors and made Stephen Curry look like an ordinary player. And I was puzzled and bewildered how that happened. And Oklahoma City was beating them with smaller lineup. They were beating with the big lineup with Adams and Ibaka. They had a great game plan, and it kind of gave the Warriors a little wake-up call. So we'll see how it all plays out. Hopefully they got the wake-up call that will continue into the series against Cleveland. I think it's going to be great, because last year it was all, you know, you kept saying, hearing how lucky the Warriors were because they didn't have to play against a healthy Cleveland team minus Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving. And I always said at that time, personally, I think the Warriors might have won even easier. They got behind 2-1 because Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving don't play much defense. And we're going to see if that's one thing I will predict. The Warriors should be able to score against this team a lot easier than they did against Oklahoma City. And so if they're going to, and Tyronn Lue has already said that he's going to push the pace. Well, if they want to get into an up and down game with the Warriors, and the Warriors, those two shooters that they have in Curry and Thompson, good luck with that. And so we'll see how it plays out.
Jim Barnett, former Trailblazer, longtime NBA player, now a broadcaster with the Warriors, is our guest. The All-NBA ballot you had was brilliant because you voted for the best players on that first team, didn't you?
Well, I tried to, and I have to tell you, I did due diligence, and then I forgot about it. I have no idea which ones I put on the first team right now, if you ask me, because I do the job, and then I move on to something else. I don't know who all I voted for, and I don't know how it all panned out if I was consistent with how the final tally came
out. You weren't
in. But I tried to, and that's why I put LeBron James as a guard,
yes,
even though I know he's a forward.
You were one of the few people that I thought just said, I've got to put Kevin Durant on that first team, and Durant did not make the first team because after people voted for Kawhi Leonard and LeBron at the forward position, they had no room to put a forward. And I looked at your ballot, and I thought, that was brilliant. He just slid LeBron to a guard position like you would do if that was your team. And
right.
you made room for Durant on that first team, which was the right thing to do.
Well, that's what I felt was right. And thank you. I'm glad, because I took a little heat on Twitter about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I may take some heat on it today from some of your listeners, but that's the way it goes. They gave me a vote. And as I say, I did my due diligence and did the best way. I tried to pick, you know, players that deserve to be on that first team. Let me ask you this, because I don't remember. Did I vote for DeAndre Jordan? Because you have to be the center in there.
So, I'm going to pull your ballot. I'll pull your ballot up.
That's all right. He got first team, and it's hard for me to understand how center.
I don't think you did. And
okay.
I'll pull your ballot up. But in the meantime, tell me what you think. How do the Warriors handle LeBron in this series?
Well, it's going to be very different than last year, because he controlled the tempo. He controlled the games, and they were lower scoring, and that's why they were able to hang in there. So I don't think it'll happen this year that way. I think it'll be more a little up and down. But they're going to put Andre Iguodala. I don't know whether, and even Harrison Barnes, just even yesterday, did not know whether he was going to go back into the starting lineup or whether it was going to be Iguodala. But they're going to try to, you know, play him one-on-one. He turns his back. They'll try to double team, make him a passer, but you have to be very, he's a heck of a passer. And so you're going to, they're going to show different schemes, singular defense, double team defense. Just, they're going to try to make him pound the ball, a little bit too much possibly, and see how it plays. And you're going to see Iguodala primarily and Harrison Barnes on, LeBron James, and try to keep him out of the lane. You know, they're going to basically try to keep him out of the lane and keep him out on the perimeter like you do with Westbrook. And that's the whole key with Russell Westbrook. Keep him out of the lane, make him shoot perimeter shots, because that's the lesser of evils.
You put, here's your ballot, your first team ballot. You put Kevin Durant and Kawhi Leonard as your forwards. You slid Draymond Green to the center position, and you put Steph Curry and LeBron at the guards. I have a hard time arguing with that lineup.
Well, Draymond is such a versatile player. It's, you know, he's, it's really strange. And he had horrible games 3 and 4. I think he got too ramped up and amped up, I should say, emotionally. And he toned that down a little bit because I think he harmed himself and the team. And so hopefully he's going to be a little more under control in this series. And I know he's got to be, you know, amped up to play, but I think he went over the top. But he is so versatile and so valuable. And many people, and I've had NBA coaches say this to me, we know Stephen Curry is the MVP of the league, but the MVP of your team may be Draymond Green. If Draymond Green had missed the amount of time that Stephen Curry missed in the first two series, Houston and your series with, up in Portland, I'm not sure the Warriors would have survived if Draymond Green had not been there, even with, say, Stephen Curry and Klay Thompson, because the Warriors, believe it or not, their biggest ally is their defense, not their offensive scoring, because their defense leads to the scoring. When they get stops and they rebound and run, that's where they can get in the open court and they destroy you. If you limit them, and the OKC did a great job of that, limiting them to half-court offense. In game 4, I believe, OKC had 62 points in the paint. It was just porous defense. Well, then they kept taking the ball out of bounds. And OKC, their transition defense, there wasn't even a challenge there. And all of a sudden, Curry was getting there. They're double-teaming him. They're making it difficult on him. He finally adjusted, by the way, a little bit, and we saw that in game 7. Beating their big men, and that's a whole other subject we could talk about if they want to switch in Cleveland. And they put bigs on Stephen Curry and Klay Thompson. They're going to go around them, particularly Stephen. But OKC did a good job of that. But when the Warriors get out into the open court, because of their good defense, they're almost impossible to stop.
Jim Barnett, you can tell that lady that she can have peace and quiet now. Thank you.
Let's see if she's still around the corner. Yeah, she's gone. She's gone. So, anyway,
she's,
I should have gone around.
She's going to be
going here for a while.
I went to the park to have a peaceful night, quiet afternoon, and then some guy was ranting about Draymond Green, yelling and screaming. There you go. Thank you, Jim.
A lot of fun. Hey, John, thank you.
Want more of the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show? Leave it right here. More with John Canzano, the Bald-Faced Truth. You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.
The 1996 NBA Rookie of the Year, Damon Stoudemire, joining us. Where are you today?
John, I am in Memphis. I'm in Memphis today.
Are you dealing with young players and slapping your forehead a lot, or?
You got to show patience, boy. You got to show patience. It's just, you know, I don't want to say it's a different kid, because that would just be cliche and everybody says that because somebody has to work with them. It's just a matter of, this is what I always say, John, and I think back to the coaches that got the most out of me, and then I think about the coaches that maybe I didn't do so great with. In order to coach a kid today, and I'm going to say this, it doesn't matter whether it's grade school, high school, NBA, college, doesn't matter. In order to coach a kid, number one, they got to trust you, because if they don't trust you, you can't coach them hard. So that's the biggest thing. And I go back to say that the biggest thing is a relationship. Got to have a relationship with these kids. Nowadays, you don't have a relationship with them, you can't coach them.
when you are recruiting or coaching a kid, or you walk into the house or meet a kid in a gym, you walk in and you're a former NBA player. If you weren't a former NBA player, would it be as easy to get that trust? Because these guys kind of know who you are, don't they?
Yeah, and everybody wants the same thing. You know, to be honest, when you go talk to a kid, you know, sometimes the kid might not know everything because, they grew up in a different era, but their parents most of the time know who I am. It does make it easy, but, you know, the thing about it is every kid nowadays aspires to want to get to the NBA, whether it happens or not. So you kind of got a built-in advantage when you are going to recruit a kid or you going in a home. But, you know, you definitely have an advantage as opposed to a guy that can't come up in there and can't say that.
If we go back, with your uncles, Charles and Anthony, who really got you involved in sports as a kid, did you forecast, did you see, all right, I'm going to play in the NBA, then I'm going to coach one day, or does it just kind of unfold for you year to year and phase to phase?
Yeah, I've talked about it, but they, you know, I don't think that in anybody's mind that, I'm not going to say they didn't think it was going to happen, but, you know, I was a big dreamer. You know, I dreamed big, and, you know, I kind of tried to map my life out, and, you know, my life kind of went accordingly, but it wasn't easy. You know, I had help along the way. They definitely helped me. You know, the one that took me to my first gym, though, was my Uncle Donald. My Uncle Donald was the one that took me up to Matt Dishman. Never forget it. I was in second grade. He took me up there. Yep.
Being a Portland kid, when you look at the Blazers, what do you see?
You know, I actually watched a little bit last night. I think it was last night they played Golden State.
Yeah.
When I look at them right now, I'll just reserve my judgment and just say it's kind of to be continued, because I guess I'm like everybody else. You're just trying to figure out where they go from here. I mean, we know what happened. It looked like in all actuality, it looked like once LaMarcus Aldridge didn't come back, they blew it up. That's what it looked like from the outside. Now, I don't know, because I don't know what's going on the inside. But the only one that looked like they were actually trying to move was Batum.
Yeah.
And then when Aldridge didn't come back, you know, I think that they kind of changed up mid-flow, you know, and I think that, they figured they'd go another way. And like I said, I'm not for sure, how they're doing it or what they got going on. But, you know, it just seems to me that at least for this year, you know, they're going to roll with some of these young guys and see what they can get out of them. And, you know, hey, you know, just kind of see what happened. And then from there, they can start trying to, you know, navigate to who we're going to keep, who we're going to get rid of, and, you know, what's out there on the free agent market. But, you know, probably the biggest thing for me when I look at everything that they do is, like, you know, with Portland, it's like you got to keep your own, man, because it gets hard to try to lure, you know, free agents to come up there, you know, and it's, you know, you usually get, Portland has usually gotten their players via trade.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of how it's been done. You know, that's just, no matter how far back you look at it, you know, who they drafted usually aren't their core guys. The guys that are the core guys usually are guys that they have traded for, you know, so.
Is that
be interesting just to see. Yeah.
You're in the league. I mean, you grew up here, so you know this market. The demographics, that we're in the Northwest, that it's a white city, that does that hurt the Blazers when they are trying to lure free agents?
You know what? I actually don't think that has anything to do with it. You know, at the end of the day, I just think that one of the things is that, you know, in Portland, it used to be an open checkbook.
Yeah.
You know, and so that open checkbook is not necessarily there, you know, anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and so when I think they had that open checkbook, I think that made it a lot easier for guys to come.
Yeah.
You know, because you know as well as I do, John, that regardless of what a lot of guys say, and with the exception of maybe David West, man, guys are going where they're going to get the most money.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that that's really the key. You know, I don't think it has nothing to do with Portland, whether it's a white city or whatever. I don't think it has anything to do with that at all. But I think that, you know, it's just, you know, it used to be an open checkbook, and really it's not an open checkbook anymore. You know, you think about what happened. You know, Dallas gave Wesley Matthews, I think, about 10, 11 million.
Yeah.
And he might not even play until, you know, January, February. That used to be what Portland did. I mean, from that standpoint, you know, I mean, I think that that's probably the biggest change in Portland, you know, when I see, you know, I think that they had for a while that they had drafted well. You know, you had D-Roy, you know, who was a franchise player. You know, unfortunately, injuries, you know, cut his career short. You know, Greg Oden, you know, injuries really cut his career short. He never really got off the ground in Portland. But in between that, they had LaMarcus, who actually turned out to be, you know, that franchise player guy. And then you get a Damian Lillard. And, you know, to me, I felt like, you know, when I seen them two playing together, I felt like Portland was ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
And so now that's why I say now it's kind of to be continued, because I just want to see where they're going, because to me they were ahead of the curve, because I think that people would be lying if they thought they were supposed to be in the place that they were just a couple years ago, winning a first round series against Houston. I didn't see that coming. But guys emerged. You know, the team gelled, you know, and they won that series. But then now it's like it's back to the drawing board. So I'm just going to just take the wait and see approach.
Do you miss being in the NBA? Will you always miss that once?
Oh, no question. I think you miss it. You know, I still talk to a lot of guys. I still keep up with the NBA, you know, a whole lot. I definitely miss it. You know, I don't miss some of the things about it. But I miss it from the standpoint, you know, more so when I was a player. I miss the camaraderie. I miss, you know, being around guys, you know, because you'll never get that back, you know. You'll never get that back. You can rehash and relive things, you know, but you'll never get that back. And I definitely miss the NBA, man. That's like, you know, that's your ultimate goal, you know, my ultimate goal as a young player was to get there and then to get there and everything. And, you know, then, you know, one thing you learn about the NBA, and I think that, like, you know, guys, you hear stories, and I think guys tend to struggle, man, but you got to find your niche in life. And a lot of these guys, you know, when they leave the NBA, they never really find their niche. You know, I have a theory, and I've always had this theory, you know, is when you leave the NBA, just like I would say if you're a professional baseball, basketball, football, you know, football, it doesn't matter. When you retire, If you're gonna go off and you're gonna go on vacation and you're gonna do all that stuff, you better have somebody up in there that knows where you're at, because once you're out of sight, you're out of mind. Well, you can't dribble that ball for that team no more. Now they don't need you. Now things change a little bit.
Yeah.
you know, and it's amazing that, you know, every year, you know, I've been fortunate enough. I get calls to come back to the NBA. You know, I get calls to change jobs all the time. You know, but I also encounter a lot of calls from other guys that I've played with and other guys in the league that ask me, man, how can I get the door slammed in your face so quick? Because, man, I try to get in, and I can't get in,
yeah.
You know? And the first thing I say to them is that you shouldn't have took no time off.
Yeah.
I said, man, it's competitive, man, out here. I said, guys are trying to do the same thing you're doing, so what are you doing to make yourself attractive to that college program or that professional team? Gotta make yourself attractive, man. And, you know, the one thing I learned is that, you know, your playing days don't really count for it. You gotta go out there and you gotta show people that you're ready to grind, and it's a whole totally different thing, you know, and I'm fine with it, but a lot of guys, you know, they can't get through that part of it, you know. And, you know, it's different, John, you know, but I'm fine though. I mean, I like what I do. I like dealing with these kids. You know, I do miss the NBA. I miss, like I said, I miss the camaraderie. But overall, you know, man, I like my life. You know, my life is still, you know, pretty much steady and flowing the same way it was, you know, just 10 years ago. So I'm good with everything and where I'm at.
You're incredibly blessed, you and your generation of players, in that you guys, if you stuck in the league, you made money. So you don't. There's a group of you that doesn't have to work, and yet I see you grinding and working, you know, behind the scenes a lot at Memphis and Arizona, and I wonder, what is that about for you? What is it? It has to be that you love the game.
Yeah, I definitely love the game. And if I didn't do this, a part of me would be dead. because that's all I know. You know, they, you know, some people grow up and they like whatever it is that they do, you know. But for me, I like basketball, I like sports, you know. The other day I was driving and I seen some kids outside playing. I just stopped and started shooting with them.
Yeah.
You know, because the stuff like that, you know, that's priceless for kids. You know, that's priceless for kids. And, you know, the thing about it is a lot of times when I'm around and when I go places and everything, you know, these kids, they're so impressionable. And, you know, a lot of them, when I first meet them, even the kids that I recruit, they want to know the end result. A lot of them want to talk about what I have. But what I talk about them is the process, man. And this process is hard, and you got to honor it all the way through. If you don't honor it and you start trying to cheat it, you know, usually you don't make it. And that's what I try to get them to understand, you know, is that you got to honor that process all the way through.
Damon Stoudemire, our guest, former NBA player. I feel like you're ready for a head coaching job. I wrote it a couple of summers ago. Every time a job opens, I expect you to get called. How difficult is it to get that serious opportunity where they really know you and they're looking at you as a serious candidate?
It's difficult. I think it is very difficult. You know, a lot of people, you know, tell me that I just need to be patient. It's gonna happen, and da da da. This, that, the third, and I'm like, man, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, yeah. I guess the way I look at it is in my own way, you know, we all are a little arrogant and we all feel like we can do the job. And I look around in certain instances and I see a lot of people with jobs. I don't even know how they got jobs, but
yeah,
they have a job. So I'm not jealous of them, but I'm just saying I just need my opportunity too. But what I try to do though, John, honestly, is that, man, instead of focusing on that, I just say, man, let me just be the best assistant I can. Let me try to make my head coach look as good as possible. And then when I get my opportunity, man, you just be ready to shine with.
I tweeted out that you're coming on the show, and immediately the jokesters on Twitter were like, oh, ask him about the metal detector. Does that stuff come up? Do people go, oh, is he mature enough? You know, he's got that thing in the past. And by the way,
nah,
and pot's legal now.
Nah, you know, probably the thing about it is that, you know, I kind of bring it up to the people because my life is an open book. And most of the people that talk about, to me, most of the people that, you know, bring up the marijuana and all that stuff on social media, man, they like cowards. You know, a lot of people are cowards. It's easy to kind of take cat calls at people from behind closed doors or, you know, typing on the computer some things. But the reality at the end of the day is that, you know, yeah, I was young. I had my issues. But, man, there's a lot more going on that's way more serious than that. So, you know, if that's the reason that, you know, I may not get a job, or that's the reason that I don't get a kid because maybe a parent says, well, man, he had his issues. Man, if we can bring the light what everybody do in the dark, man, this world would be really tore up right now. You know, and when we do seem to bring some of that stuff to light, you know, we start to find out a lot of idiosyncrasies about people that we thought we knew, and we find out that they're a little different. So, John, I'm totally fine with who I am as a person, and I don't hide from who I am. And, you know, I'll answer that question for anybody. But most of the people, like I say, they come up to me, and believe it or not, John, I don't really get that a lot.
Yeah,
I don't really get that. You know, but at the same time, too, you know, I think that, you know, there's still that minority of people out there that's always going to remember that. But to me, that's for losers and lowlifes who don't have nothing else to do with their life.
You've been in a lot of locker rooms, and I think this is a really important question. What does being a good teammate mean in an NBA locker room? What is a good teammate?
And being a good teammate is being there for somebody when it's not going good for yourself. You know how hard that is? Like to me, the thing that I took satisfaction with when I played with the Blazers, especially when I was going through my little issues, is that, man, I was always there for everybody. I rooted for everybody. I never complained. I never said nothing. you know, I really just took what came to me and just, you know, went on about my business. But man, to be a good teammate in this league, you know, and it's a selfish league, you know, and that's probably the biggest thing. It's a selfish league, you know. If you can earn the trust of them guys in the locker room and they know that you truly for them, you know, every day, you know, whether it's going good for you or not, because that's the key. It's easy to be a good teammate when it's going good for you, you know. But what about when you get benched and then you got to root for that dude that took your job, you know, because it's a long season, man. Things change,
yeah.
You know, and they change every day. You know, so you really, you got to be prepared for the worst. You know, you got to be prepared for the worst. And, you know, what I see going on now, at least with the teams that win, you know, you look at Golden State, that's what Golden State had. You know, Golden State had unselfishness. You know, Andre Iguodala, I mean, he started his whole life. You know, I know Dre. I know Dre don't like coming off the bench, but he did. You know what I mean? When he just stuck with it, you know, then eventually at the end of the day, he got rewarded by winning, you know, finals MVP. But if he don't do that, is that team going to be good? Is it going to be the same team? Nah, it won't be the same team. You know, but he allowed other guys to emerge. You know, he allowed other guys. He allows a Draymond Green to emerge. He allows a Harrison Barnes to emerge. You know, those guys don't emerge if Drake and Plains. You know, so, I mean, to me, to be a good teammate in that locker room is when it's not going well for you. Are you still doing the best for each individual in that locker room? And what's best for that organization to help out? You know, that's what a good teammate is. That's what a good teammate is to me. Whatever that might be.
You know, I always found you in that corner of that locker room, and when things were tough for the Blazers or whatever, you were always a guy who spoke. You always talked. Often I felt like you would speak for the team in a way that it was thoughtful and it was real. Like you didn't always say what was popular. How were you able to do that when so many guys don't want to be real about what's going on with a team? When things are bad, everyone can see it on the outside, and people say, you know, they give you the cliche. You were always willing to tell the truth.
Well, you know, I felt like, one, I just owed it to everybody to be that person, you know, considering I was from there, from Portland, and, you know, you just can't run from stuff. You know, you can't run. And like you say, it was some moments where it got tough up in there, and I know guys really didn't want to talk, you know, at times. And I know you guys had a tough time getting what you needed. And, you know, I just tried to always, you know, be that guy that you know, hey, if you need something, I can give it to you. I don't know if I can give you what you want, but I'm going to give you what I think.
Yeah. Well, and you were, you know, the only thing I would have changed was you were a slow dresser, man. Putting on your socks, putting on your shoes, buttoning up your shirt. It's like half an hour.
Let's be honest. Man, I was trying to leave the locker room smelling good, doing all that. Man, Cass was out of there so quick. I don't know whether they just didn't like the place and they was trying to get out, but I was good, you know. I was good. And you know what? Y'all didn't mind, because if you didn't get those good quotes, you wait for me at the end.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
It worked out. Damon, you've been a good friend, and we love having you on the show, and I think people love hearing what you're doing, and I know that there are a lot of people rooting for you, because you're 42 years old. You've got a long coaching career in front of you if you want it.
All right. Well, I appreciate that, man. You know, I'll come back on the show sometime.
You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show. Stay tuned for more.
Something is about to happen.
BFT.
Now listen up, everyone.
Let's go. The Bald-Faced Truth.
John Canzano.
I gotta say, I love him most of the time. I think he's right on.
He's okay.
John's great.
He's a little unusual.
Live every afternoon, 12 to 3 p.m.
I hate that guy, because he just never knows what he's talking about.
I think he does a damn good job.
That's my dude, man. Yeah, I know him, man. I let my mother listen to him.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a Bald-Faced Truth. Welcome to a special edition of the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.
Rudy Tomjanovich joining us now. What do you remember of, like, that first championship in 94?
Hey, John, good to be with you.
The 94 team wins it, and you come back in 95, and you get the Orlando Magic in the finals, and you win that one. You were a sixth seed in 95. Did you feel like, because of 94, it didn't matter that you were the sixth seed, or was that a real surprise even to you as it developed?
Well, you know, things weren't working the same way they did the year before, and we had an opportunity to get Clyde Drexler, who was a phenomenal player and had Houston ties. You know, I would have said I would have never broken up a championship team, but to get a player like him, and we were playing pretty bad at the time, I thought it was the thing to do. And what was crazy is we never got that team to play as a whole team because of injuries during that season, and I kept telling the media and the team I thought we'd be better, but they were just staring at me like, has this guy gone crazy? And then finally, in the first round of the playoffs, we got everybody back going again and had a tight series with Utah, and I think everybody started believing again.
People in Portland kind of rue that day that Clyde was traded away and he goes to Houston, he wins a championship. Was that a deal that, did Portland come to you guys, or did you, you know, you mentioned that you were kind of sputtering. Did you come to Portland looking for Clyde, or how did that come about?
You know, I can't answer that. I know that I had seen the rumor, and you'll do that every year. You'll see some stuff and say, well, where the heck did that kind of stuff come from? Because I think I saw it in the paper before anybody in our office brought it to my attention. And I said, you mean that could really happen? And then we start taking it serious. But I don't know who contacted who.
I've heard Clyde wasn't much of a practice player, but in games we all saw what he could do. Was he just one of those guys that flipped the switch, or do you agree with that?
Well, you know, we didn't have much practice that year because he came in the middle of the year.
That's right.
He hadn't been through that training camp. And the next year he did practice well. You know, but you learn just as Coach Popovich has, you know, as players get older, you've got to save their legs. And they're smart enough to know a lot of your practice is done in the film room. And, you know, going over strategies and saving their legs.
We're talking to Rudy Tomjanovich, two-time NBA champion as a coach, five-time All-Star as a player. I'm looking back at your first All-Star game in 1974, and you walk into that locker room, and it's got Walt Frazier and Pete Maravich and John Havlicek are in there. What'd you think with that group of players around you?
You know, I was just in heaven. Just to be in the NBA was a big deal. And then to be in an All-Star game when the coaches, I really felt good about the coaches voting me in. And I think every year but one, the coaches put me in. And that was important to me because you sort of wanted to feel respected by the guys you were playing against. And but then to be in the locker room with those guys and, you know, go through the banquets and sit next to some of these guys, get to know them a little bit, it was pretty cool.
We see Steph Curry now, and he, we talk about, well, he's the most, one of the more creative players ever in the NBA, and he draws comparisons to Rick Barry or Pete Maravich. And is that you played with Maravich? I mean, is that a fair comparison with Steph Curry, or is that apples and oranges?
Well, you know, I think Steph Curry's in a league of his own. There have been guys sort of like him, but I've never seen anybody with the skill level that he has. And with the range that he has, and how he can take a situation where there isn't a shot and create a shot for himself. And, you know, that would be enough if he just did that. But the kid plays without the ball, and he's a great cutter. He has a great feel for the game. I love his penetration when he goes in there, and you just, you know, the first couple of years in the league, you sort of felt like, God, I hope this guy doesn't get hurt. He's so tiny, you know. And now he goes in there, and he's got seven-footers swatting at it, and he doesn't even break stride. I mean, he makes the most difficult shots in balance, right over a seven-footer. Out of all the players I've seen, I think I've been more awed by him. And I'm a guy who does get awed by players. So, you know, first time I saw Dr. J, I thought that was a big deal, the stuff that he could do. And this guy, you know, I just think it's just, he's a phenomenal basketball player. And he's setting the bar so high, I can't wait for the future to see, you know, where somebody's going to use him as a role model and maybe even improve on what he does.
As a coach, you got kind of a reputation of being a player's coach and that veteran players liked you. And how much of that was just your personality and given that you had been a player that you knew it was important to trust guys? Or how much of that was, hey, I need talent, and if I'm going to get veteran talent, I'm going to have this style?
You know, that's a very good question. It wasn't by design. I don't think I have the personality of a drill sergeant type guy, you know. And I was one of those guys that I always saw the cup, you know, half full. And, you know, I just saw the good stuff in my players, and I tried to accent that. And, you know, I would tailor make offenses to fit the personnel that I had. And, you know, I think that reflected how I felt about them. It just mirrored itself back to me. And I was really, really blessed because it's a tough business. It really is a tough business when the guy who's making the decisions, you know, doesn't make the kind of money that the guys that are under your charge, you know. So I look back sometime and I'm just amazed that the success that the Rockets had and all that, you know, because it isn't an easy job and everybody's going for the same thing.
I look at sort of the way that you coached and the physical and mental exhaustion that goes into that. We've seen it with Dick Vermeil. We've seen it with other coaches. How much of that, you know, the pressure that you put internally on yourself and your staff? I mean, at the end of the season, did you just feel like you're ready to collapse?
Well, I've collapsed several times in my career, and that's what I had to get out of when I came to Los Angeles. You know, a dream job, and I love the situation. But the way that I do my job is I just don't stop. And I didn't know how to turn it off. And, you know, that's what made me a good coach also made me a coach who had to give it up after 11 or 12 years because I put my health in jeopardy. You know, that's the one thing I never, you know, I had cancer and had to leave the Rockets, and I figure, you know, the cancer's gone, and, you know, I was just 1 year away from the game, and the Lakers come calling, and, you know, I didn't have any plans to coach right away, but they come calling, and I agree to do that because it's such a wonderful place and wonderful franchise, but it's probably the wrong thing to do so fast after treatment. And, you know, so I had to do the right thing and tell Dr. Buss, you know, I thought I made a mistake. And they've been so good to me since then. You know, I still work for the franchise. And, and I really enjoy my work. I'm just not on the front line.
You're happy with that, being around the game, and but not being in the trenches?
You know, just to save myself, yeah.
Yeah.
Once in a while, you know, I look at and I get to talk to the coaches sometime and assistant coaches, you know, and I'll get all worked up about I like to be creative, and I still, believe it or not, I still X and O, and I'm doing a lot of scouting on free agents. So I see, you know, what's going on in the NBA right now, and it's sort of the way that I believe the game should be played, with spacing and, you know, always trying to get the ball close to the basket. But if they take that away from you, use the three-point shot, you know, and that's what the whole league has become. And it's a really exciting style of basketball.
Rudy Tomjanovich is our guest, two-time NBA champion as a coach, five-time All-Star as a player, now a scout in the Lakers organization. The 2000 Olympic Games in Sydney, I was there covering it as a newspaper writer, and I remember Sharif Abdur-Rahim and Ray Allen and Vince Carter and Kevin Garnett and Gary Payton, and, you know, you have a chance to coach a team that represents your country. What did that mean to you?
Oh, it meant everything, you know. When I was a college player, it was so hard to even get invited to try out for the team. You know, I was in a draft that had tremendous players in 70. So you go back to 68, I think, when the Olympics was. And there were just a few guys, you know, Spencer Haywood was the guy who made it, who's the big name. And the rest of the guys you really didn't know much about, and sort of felt, you know, that I could have been a member of that team on skill, and it was a regret, you know. But then to go out there and represent our country in the Olympics was such a big deal and such a wonderful honor. But you talk about pressure. You know, we were in a game with Lithuania.
Yep.
They had a great, great strategy. They started in a man-to-man on the play, on an individual possession. But as soon as we got the ball in, everybody just sort of zoned up. And in the NBA, we still had the illegal defensive rules. So our guys were not used to having somebody just play an area. And it affected our game. So with about a minute to go, we were down by one, and we fouled a three-point shooter. And he was a great free-throw shooter, too, for Lithuania. Luckily, he only made one out of three. And that last minute, when I wasn't thinking about basketball and my thoughts got away from me, I could just see, you know, at the end of my career or at my funeral, you know, people say, he was a good player, he was a good dad, a good friend, but that dummy lost, you know, the first game with the NBA players. And we pulled that game out. And how we did it by scrambling on the floor, and McDice, Antonio McDice, was the guy who put the ball in, and he was so excited after the game. I went up to give him a hug. He couldn't breathe because he was the guy who had fouled the three-point shooter.
Oh, man.
He thought he was going to be the GOAT. So, boy, what a wonderful feeling. And then we won the next game against France, and it was more a sigh of relief when it was over, because everybody expects us to win the game. And one of my assistant coaches was Gene Cady, the big tough guy from Purdue. And when I turned to him to shake his hand, he had tears in his eyes, and because he had been there before in different situations, and he knew that it wasn't easy. And then it really hit me, you know, that we did pull it off, and we kept that string going.
Our guest, Rudy Tomjanovich, wins a gold medal as a coach of that team in 2000. By the way, McDice scored 2 points in that game that you're talking about. That was his only basket of that game, along with 6 rebounds, as I'm looking at the box score.
Yep.
Pretty special. Coach, this week we've talked to coaches at all levels about preparing a team in competition. And so one of the questions and one of the themes that comes up is, you know, there are teams that are extremely talented that, for whatever reason, don't put it together on the court in competition. How did you, over the years, manage very talented teams as you tried to prepare them to get that to transfer into a talented performance? And were you ever in a case where you had a team that was just loaded and you're like, I can't quite get them together in the way that I want them together?
Well, I was lucky that I didn't. That I had young teams that did that after the championship team. But the way that I did it is when we would scrimmage and work on things in time segments, and I'd let them know what time of the game it was. So usually 80% of the time we played basketball in a very aggressive way, where you want to, you know, look up the court, try to advance it on the break as much as you could. But then I would say, we're in the fourth quarter. Now we're playing it close to the vest. Now we will take fast breaks. If somebody's not going to get back, we're going to make them pay. But we're not taking any chances. We're not going to, throw some Hail Mary passes the length of the court and things like that. So, and then we would execute the plays that were our fourth quarter plays. And everybody would know they were coming and what they would have to do, unless they had some phenomenal defensive player that could guard a key one-on-one. We knew that they had to double team, and then we worked on moving the ball to the open man. And I think you still see it in basketball today. You just don't see many post-ups because there just aren't that many great post-up players, but that's exactly what Golden State does. They create a situation where somebody's got to move over to help, and then they get the ball moving, you know, faster than the defense can rotate it. It's just beautiful basketball.
And kids in driveways now are wearing Steph Curry jerseys, and everybody's shooting threes. And I wonder if we ever get back to a back-to-the-basket big man, especially a 7-foot kid. Is that era past? Will we see it again?
Well, you know, I think it'll come back depending on the players. And you could still post up small guys too, but with the way the defense, you know, the game was dominated by big guys when we had illegal defensive rules, which I was a big, big, big fan of. I thought, you know, you could still double team, but you had to do it aggressively. You couldn't, as soon as you see somebody going down there, run two guys across the floor. And I thought it was going to really hurt the game, and it probably we could really have a truly amazing game now with the players we have with that kind of spacing. But I thought it would hurt percentages, and it did for the first couple years. But to the credit of the coaches and the players, they have adjusted very well to team zoning up and just playing areas. And it's a credit to the coaches and the players.
Want more of the best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show? Leave it right here. This is the Bald-Faced Truth. You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show.
Portland selects Sam Bowie, University of Kentucky.
Our next guest, former first-round draft pick, high school sensation, Sam Bowie, joining us now here on 750 The Game. Sam, thanks for making time.
Oh, you're very welcome, and happy holidays, everyone.
Happy holidays to you. Where are you today?
I'm in Lexington, Kentucky.
That's home for you now, and I saw the documentary that will air on Thursday on ESPNU, and I thought it was fantastic. I thought the access that you gave them was amazing. Was this something that you embraced?
Well, to be honest with you, they had tried to contact me for months in regards to doing this documentary, and I was kind of running from them. I had no desire to have some self-publicity, self-exposure. I've never been one of those type of people, but finally we got a hold of each other, and I opted to do it, and now that the documentary's been completed, I've been very pleased with the story that they told.
You're happy with it? I thought it was real. I mean, they got access. How much time did they spend with you?
It was very time consuming. Months and months. I'm going to say maybe 7-8 months of us being in different sites and the interview process. But I thought they did a thorough job in telling the story.
You know, and I, you know, as a sports columnist and a host of a radio show here in Portland, you know, I thought I knew the story of Sam Bowie. And I think in watching that documentary, really learned about sort of the backstory of you, which was the missing piece for me. It's your family upbringing, your mom, and sort of how you were heralded as, you know, the guy out of high school and the million dollar kid. And all that sort of gave me context that I think is really valuable here.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because I've always had a great relationship with the media and the press. And when this thing come about, the first article I saw from a Yahoo ordeal where it kind of came across negative in the sense that I tricked or deceived or I lied to the Portland medical staff. And I think once the general public gets to see the actual documentary, that they will perceive me in a different way, because I don't have that demeanor in me. I was raised differently, and I must say that that kind of affected me, that it got negative publicity as far as the documentary was concerned, because that was not the case whatsoever.
And I think what they got was they hear kind of the context of the documentary, for those who haven't seen it, which is most people, but I got a chance to watch it the other night, was there's a sequence in which they're talking about the injuries that you had in college and, you know, you preparing for the draft and the Blazers doing their diligence and having their medical staff check you out. There, you acknowledge in the video or on the documentary that you weren't 100%, that you weren't right. And you feel like you were honest with the Blazers training staff about that.
Yes, sir. And the thing about it is the context that was published, if you see the whole documentary like yourself, you'll get a full appreciation of what was involved. And the thing that kind of bothered me was when the question was asked about that whole ordeal about going through the rigorous examination that I went through with Dr. Cook and his staff and the Portland organization, I had no time premeditated to deceive or lie or trick or try and say something that wasn't true to form. But the physical itself, when they examined me, they checked my ankles, knees, shoulders, hips. You can imagine when they're talking about paying the type of money that they pay a guy that was going to be the second pick, they did their due diligence. All I was saying was when I went through my physical, when they took the mallet and hit on my left tibia, my response was that there was no discomfort, no pain, I'm ready to go. And even though I was never going to be the player I once was before I got injured in Kentucky, I was telling them that my leg was to the point where I could participate, play, and bring a championship to the Portland Trailblazers. And the thing that bothers me is after I passed the MRIs, the bone scans, the x-rays, I wound up playing 76 out of a possible 82-game schedule, and I didn't start having reoccurrences with my leg problems until Jerome Kersey fell on it the second year of my career. So to say that I deceived or that I knew the leg was going to break couldn't be any further from the truth.
We're visiting with Sam Bowie, former Blazer, former high draft pick, obviously the 1984 draft, second pick overall by Portland. How heartbreaking is it for you in watching that to go back and see yourself as that nimble high school kid who could jump, who could shoot it, who could run, even at Kentucky when you got there before that injury on the fast break? You were a player in watching that film that was a generational player. How hard is it and heartbreaking is it for you to see that and go, man, I never got to do that at the next level on any kind of consistent basis?
That's interesting that you would word it that way, because it was educational for me. I think a lot of times when you're going through whatever profession it might be, you really don't have time to recollect and sit back and enjoy the accomplishments that one has achieved. But the thing I got out of the documentary was I had forgotten that I was, quote, supposed to be the best high school player in the country, that my first 2 years at the University of Kentucky prior to the injury at Vanderbilt, that I was able to accomplish what I did athletically. So it was good for me to watch and see, and I was amazed at the material that ESPN was able to gather to show, like the Olympics, when I participated and made the 1980 Olympic team, and we boycotted under President Carter. So as much of a fan as I am towards any documentary, it's kind of strange and weird watching a documentary on yourself, but to say that I was proud and would be an understatement. I thought they did an excellent job of telling my story.
Sam Bowie joining us here on 750 The Game. This is going to come out on Thursday, and it's going to air several times across the ESPN networks, and I'm sure your phone's going to start ringing and people are going to start talking about it. Was your hesitation in initially participating tied to, look, I want to leave this in the past, I don't want to relive it? Was that your initial reaction?
No, I think my initial reaction was I didn't think I was worthy of having a story told. Obviously, my career did not turn out like others had anticipated, as well as myself. But I've never been real big on self-publicity, self-exposure. And I think the biggest hesitation that I had was I'm just not very comfortable with people thinking that I was special and there was a story to be told.
The Blazers as an organization have tried to move forward, and you still come up regularly. I'm sure you're asked daily about, you know, your career in basketball. But when you look at your life after basketball, I see a guy who's raised kids, who has found something that he loves in the horse racing and horses, and I see Sam Bowie evolving as a person. How far away does that basketball career feel to you?
It feels miles away, and the one thing that I will brag about is my children. I have three children, a 22-year-old daughter that just graduated from the University of Vanderbilt. I have a 16-year-old daughter that's a sophomore, and I have a 13-year-old son. So for me to be a 51-year-old man here in Lexington, Kentucky now, and I haven't played ball since I left the Lakers in the mid-90s, around 95, my life, I've been very blessed, very fortunate, and I've had people ask me constantly, do you ever try and reminisce and visualize what it would be like if you would not have got injured and what your career would have been? But that would be so unfair on my behalf, because I feel like no one has been blessed more than Sam Bowie. I'm in Lexington, Kentucky now. I've never had a job. I've been blessed to surround myself around some financial advisors that have set me and my children up for life. And life has been very good. And the Portland, the city of Portland and the state of Oregon, I said it when I was there and I'll say it now, they could not have been any more supportive and polite during my whole ordeal of all the setbacks.
I mean, I could see the expressions on people's faces as you were carried out or wheeled out, and people really emotionally were in it with you.
And that is the thoughts and the scenes that I have. When I think of Portland, a lot of people would say, I bet you he went through a lot of ridicule, and I bet you there was a lot of conversation about
I can't believe we drafted this bus and Michael Jordan was available. But I can honestly say that during my stay in Portland, I received none of that. And that's what it's all about. I just, if there's any wishing going on, not for myself, not for self-acclaim, but I wish I would have stayed healthy and we would have won a championship to justify me being selected as a second pick. But as you well know, you cannot foresee the injuries that I had in the future. And people will say we could have had Michael Jordan. But at that time, they already had two all-star two guards in Clyde Drexler and Jim Paxson. And so anyways, I keep reiterating this, and I sound like I'm repeating myself, but I just want to continuously thank all the loved ones out there because I've received nothing but support, even though I wasn't on the floor.
Sam Bowie, our guest, you know, at the end of your career in the documentary, you talk about, you know, the seasons that you lost, and you played a 10-year career in the NBA. You played 10 years, and it probably felt like 30 because of the injuries and the rehabbing and having to come back mentally from those things. But the Lakers came to you in 95. They were willing to offer you an extension.
Yeah, Jerry West was the general manager at the time, and they were just in the process of trading for Shaquille O'Neal out of Orlando. And I was elated that Jerry West thought my skills were still to the point where I can contribute and be a factor. And he told me, he said, Sam, the toughest part of my job is to tell a kid that we're going to have to cut him or to tell a kid that we're not going to be able to give him as much money as his agent wants. He said that he had never been in a situation where a kid told him, no, he doesn't want an extension. And so I feel very honored, very flattered that that someone of his notoriety and experience would think that I could still contribute to the Lakers. But physically and mentally, I was kind of beat up, and I just couldn't block shots that I thought I used to be able to get to. I couldn't run the floor like I used to, and I just thought that it was time for me to head back to Lexington, and I never wanted to be one to just take money to be taking it. And Jerry will tell you himself, you know, I would have had a 2-year guaranteed millions of dollars contract, and I could have signed it today and then tomorrow tell him that my leg hurts and the money would have been guaranteed, but that's never been my makeup.
Have you talked to Greg Oden? And because people link you guys together with the injuries and that you were both big men, and they go Walton, Bowie, Oden, Portland can't catch a break. Have you ever had a conversation with Greg?
No, but I followed Greg from the sidelines, never had the pleasure to meet him, but I can only imagine what his mindset must be because, obviously, I followed Bill Walton, and he had all the foot injuries. Then Greg's drafted as the first pick, and they say, here we go again, another Sam Bowie. And a lot of times the general public's perception, they see athletes making tens of millions of dollars, and they say, well, Greg Odom's fine. He's made millions of dollars. He got guaranteed money. But there is a part that that we all want to be worthy of what we're being compensated. So when you talk about Greg, I feel for the kid.
Sam Bowie, our guest here on 750 The Game. In the documentary, you know, you talk about the doctors, and I want to clear this up because I want to give you an opportunity here to speak to it because people got real upset when they heard the Yahoo report that the doctors were tapping on your leg, asking if you were in pain. Did you tell them that you weren't in pain when you were in pain?
What I told them was when they said, how does this feel? I told them it feels good, there's no problem. Well, I could feel the sensation, but my point is, I told them, when you go for a job interview, and that's what that was, I was there to sell myself, to try and set up not only for myself, but all my loved ones. And don't get me wrong, a dollar's not the sole motivating factor for me, but I think yourself or anybody else who was in my position, when you're going for an interview and a workout like I did with the Portland Trail Blazers, every time they would check something, if they checked my shoulder, if they checked my hips, my knees, my ankles, and I had a little discomfort or pain, at no time would I ever express to them saying, hey, when you hit me with, excuse me, when you hit me with that mallet, there's all kind of discomfort and I feel as though the leg is going to break. It was never a situation like that. So I just, but to answer your question, what I said was when they hit me with the mallet, I said I didn't have any pain, any discomfort. And their examination indicated to them that there was no hairline fracture, no residue from past fractures. So I was there to go through a thorough examination on one day. I mean, I went from one doctor's office to the next. And the problem I have with that is I played a full season. The leg, I didn't lie to them about my leg, and Dr. Cook didn't call up the report because the records will show that I played in 76 of the 82 games.
Why horses? Why have you, you're after basketball. What is it about horses in that industry and the animals that appeals to you?
Well, when you come to the University of Kentucky, Kentucky is the horse capital of the world. And I always said if I was fortunate enough to get an extra dollar, I would buy a horse or two. And the horses, it's a lot similar to professional athletes because a lot of people think you throw the ball up and the game begins, but there's so much preparation that goes in prior to us going on the floor and playing the game. And just like with horses, once you buy them at the yearling sale, you've got to train them, you've got to take care of them, and you just don't buy them and put them in a starting gate and off they go. So I think the relationship between the two, the competition, and I've always looked at the horse as though he's an athlete.
I think it's interesting. I think there's some psychology there. You've got these animals and you and maybe and I know that you had a horse that you really believed in early on that made a big comeback and you're real proud of that. But I commend you. I think the access in this documentary is fantastic. I think people are going to want to watch it. I think it's going to help people understand you and kind of what you went through. And I think they also can see what, Sam Bowie did after basketball and the life and the person that you are. And I think it's great that you came on this show, and I've talked to you before for a newspaper column. I've never found you anything but professional and candid. And I think it's just a fantastic piece of history here. And I commend you for participating in it.
Well, I can't thank you enough for saying that because, I was raised where I respect all. I appreciate everyone's profession. And for you to say what you just said there, that means more to me than any bucket or any game or any million-dollar contract that I might have signed. I just wish that the listeners and whoever watches the documentary knows that I never took any of that for granted. I would never lie or deceive anyone. And I've said it while I was out there in Portland, and I'll say it again, that I thoroughly appreciate the support that I received out there. And anytime I can be beneficial for your station or anybody else, I'm all about giving back because I've had a lot of help along the way.
There he is, Sam Bowie. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show. Stay tuned for more.
So I want you all to listen up. This is important stuff, all right?
Okay. Here we go.
The Bald Face Truth.
Call 503-417-7575 or 877-733-0750 or text to 64636.
Here we go in 3, 2.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a Bald Face Truth. Welcome to a special edition of the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.
Former Trailblazer, former NBA player Brian Grant joining us. Do you watch the game still, Brian Grant?
No, I can't say that. I really do. I mean, I'll watch it if it's like a game seven or something like that, but kind of hard to follow.
It is. I find the same thing. I have a hard time staying mentally tuned into the season. It's so long. The games don't mean anything. We all knew where it was going. Is it something else for you, or does that play a role too?
It's just that, the difference in talent on the teams that are playing is just so it's such a huge gap. It's hard to watch that. I mean, a lot of times I find myself watching cats like Draymond Green, because to me he's about the closest thing to what I remember basketball to be when I played.
What could they do to fix that?
I mean, it's the league. It's not really the players. It's the league with all the rules and, changes and things. I mean, some of them were needed, definitely. Yeah, but I think it's gotten to the point where, guys like, Stephen Curry can really get off like that, and that's great. I think he's one of the great talents, but I would have really loved to seen him get that off on Gary Payton. You know, guys that when you could, you know, hold and grab a little bit, and you could be more physical, but that's not taking anything away from him. I'm just saying I would love to see that.
And I think you're not alone in that, because we hear from a lot of players who are watching the players today going, well, it's a different game. It's a more offensive game. Would that have suited you, or would that have been a game you would have had a harder time playing?
I don't think I would have been able to, you know, be as successful in the league as I was playing in today's league. And not that, you know, I did a whole lot, but, you know, I knew that I could go out there on any night and play as hard as I want and as physical as I want until it got to the point where it's like, all right, Brian, I'm going to have to call that on you if you keep doing it. And give me a chance. You know, guys didn't tone it down from the jump. Guys didn't tone it down until referee got involved and whispered in your ear, you know, I'm going to have to call that if you keep doing it kind of stuff.
We see that players talk all the time about how you policed yourselves. Give us an example of that. How did you police yourselves?
As far as what?
As far as, like, keeping each other honest or, you know, when it got to be a dirty play versus a good, hard, physical play, was there retaliation if a guy was taking shots at you?
I mean, there's always just those games where it seems like two cats don't like each other that are on opposite teams. And, you know, those kind of things that happen. But for the most part, you know, I don't think guys were going out to hurt guys, but it was just a different game and the physicalness of it. If you showed, you know, even when I played, the guys that played before me said that we were getting soft, you know. and if you look back at it and you see Mo Lucas throwing them up, throwing them down, we were soft compared to them. So, you know, as far as policing, you know, I think, you know, there's enough camaraderie between players to be like, okay, man, hey, man, that's, you're getting a little dirty now. You know, stop it, and we had to do something about it.
Brian Grant, former Trailblazer, former NBA player, is with us. You were the last quality, big-name, splashy free agent to come to Portland, and you've stayed in Portland. So tell us why guys won't come here.
Well, you can look out your window right now and see it. you know, if they'd have got here 2 days before, you know, now the weather's not an issue. It's, man, look at these snow-capped mountains. Man, look at all these great restaurants. You know, these people are kind of crazy, but it's a good environment. But instead, it's, you know, most guys remember what they see during the season, and that's just rain. You know, and it's when you're that young or you're just coming into it, you're not really thinking, oh, a great place with a great community for my kids, which Portland absolutely is. You're thinking of there's no sunshine, probably no place to get out. Those kinds of things.
You've stayed here. You've raised kids here. You now have kids that are playing sports. What's it like for you to watch your kids now play sports?
It's terrible, man. I tell you, like, just, you know, watching my boys go through basketball, because it's like some things that I see them doing out there, I see that they definitely get it from me, but then there's times when there's things that are out of your control.
Yeah.
You know, with coaches and things like that. And that's the hard part, because, you know, not that anything bad happened, but it was just hard to watch my two sons go through their 4 years in basketball, playing basketball here. Even though my youngest won three, was, you know, I think he got three or two of the titles that we won out here in the past 4 years. It was great. And that's just me selfishly being a father.
Yeah.
You know? I'm happy for the team. I'm happy for the organization and the coaching staff. But it's like, you know, as a father, you always think there's something wrong.
Yeah, and I think, too, it's changed, because I knew even when I grew up, the baseball season or the football season was a short season, and then you went and played something else. And I watch now, and these kids are playing year-round, and they've got trainers, and then there's the high school season and the club season, and then there's tournaments. Right. And I'm a little worried about where it's all going.
Yeah, it's definitely like not the way it was when I was growing up. It was just, you play basketball, you play, we didn't have a football team, so baseball or basketball really was available to us. And then they brought soccer to town, and that didn't work for me.
You grew up in Ohio, and I know we've talked before about you love fishing. You got that from your grandparents and fishing in the river there that wasn't always clean. What do you remember from those fishing trips?
It was one of those things where if my dad even let us go, that was something, because we had to go to Ripley, which was probably about 15 minutes away. And we'd always get out there right before the sun went down. They'd get their, chicken livers or cut up fish, throw them out there, set their poles, put the bells on them, build a little bonfire, and then start drinking beer. So as a kid, we were just running around. As soon as you heard that bell, somebody jumped up trying to snag this fish. It's a lot different back there, fishing back there than it is here. Here, it's like, I haven't been out yet because I don't know which rig to use. I don't know what, how am I supposed to tie this knot? And no planers. We're using weights. And now we're using the super wobbler flasher. And it's crazy.
And you have sea lions to worry about.
Oh, yeah. Not to mention the sea lions. I mean, just dirty pollution and stuff in Ohio. But, I mean, here, if you hook a nice one, you better get that thing in before a sea lion hits the water.
I went out with one of those fishing guides, and I said to him, like, okay, how do you do this with the sea lions? And he says, you just start, you get it, like, you reel it in like crazy. There's no fight. Just get it in the boat because sea lion's coming.
Don't stand up. If you stand up, they head right for you. You can be in a boat and not even have a fish. Yeah, everybody stand up, you'll see them hit the water, start swimming towards you.
So they're just watching. They go, when they stand up, there's a fish.
Yeah.
Brian Grant with us, former NBA player. Thomas Tyner, who's going now from Oregon to Oregon State as a football player, he's a big fisherman. He likes hunting. He's mentioned to me he'd love to go out fishing with you.
Hey, anytime, man. I have a boat. I just, I need to get out with a couple of guides myself just to get some tips on what everyone's using and places to hit and places to avoid. But, yeah. Well, yeah, anytime, man. I love fishing.
We'll have to set that up. What is it about fishing that you love? Because some people find it boring. They say you're just sitting there. It's boring.
Well, it's my grandfather. He taught me how to fish. And my grandpa's like a true country boy. I mean, this guy is a guy that go rabbit hunting. Wouldn't get a rabbit. Wouldn't get any kind of quail or any game fowl, he'd come home with a damn robin and start plucking. I'm like, that's not no. What are you doing with that, Grandpa? He's like, hey, I had to get something. And dude, it's eating possum, raccoon. I've had all that, too. I just think back to it, man. But him, he grew up in that era where, you ate what was on the table where you don't eat.
Yeah.
Sometimes it might be those things, you know what I mean? But anyway, he got me out fishing, and he would take me and two or three of my cousins, and it was just good watching him teach us how to, like, land fish. And the biggest, best fish that we were catching were carps, big old carps.
Yeah.
Big buffalo carps.
You go off to college, and obviously it works out for you because you end up in the NBA. But did you think all along you were going to play in the NBA, or at what point did Brian Grant – when did you know it was going to happen for you?
No. You know what? I didn't know until the day I was – that's a lie. I knew I was going to get drafted. But when my college season was up, I started looking for a job at, like, Procter & Gamble, General Electric. And then Pete Gillen asked me if I'd meet with three agents about possibly playing ball. I said, sure, why not? Two of them told me if I went to the camps that I would play myself out of a possible second-round pick or overseas. Mark Bartlestein from Priority Sports came in. He was young. It wasn't Bartlestein and Associates then. He came in and said, if you don't play, be the biggest mistake of your life. So I went to Phoenix, and I can just remember everybody talking about the letters they got under the door. And I said, well, I got New York. And some dude looks at me and goes, man, everybody gets New York. So I said, okay, strike one with you, buddy. in the morning, they had us go through a skills camp, seven of us in Phoenix around the gym. I threw the ball up and hit the top of the backboard, and all the GMs and stuff started laughing. So I almost ran out of there, but I didn't. And the last part of that story, I had Casey Jones as a coach, and Khalid Reeves and Anthony Goldwire as my guards. And I went up to him and told him, hey, if I get that rebound, beat everybody down the floor, will you throw it back to me? And they said, yes. That's what happened. Ended up with like 22 points and 20 rebounds. The next day, my mailbox was full.
That's a great story. You outworked people. Where'd you get the work ethic? Was it grandpa and dad?
My grandfather. I can remember being as young as 7, 8, him coming to pick me up, and we'd be digging potatoes all day.
Yeah.
All these bags of potatoes. And then at the end of the day, I think we got like a couple bags for us to take home. But I was just enjoying being with him. And then he taught me how to cut tobacco when I was like 12, 13. And I can remember a hard day in the field, come home to his house, and we'd just lay on the porch. It'd start raining. And he had one of them tin roofs. Yeah. You'd just be knocked out.
You still hear that sound of the rain on the tin roof, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Brian Grant with us. The Brian Grant Foundation's done great things with Parkinson's and research and raising money and awareness. Where are you with the disease, and how are you feeling?
You know, I've experienced a couple of things, you know, this year, changes that were like, wow, you know, because after, you know, I went for a long time, probably about 8 to 9 months, where I almost forgot I had Parkinson's because my tremor and things and other things were really settled.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's what this disease does to you. It's like right when you get to the point, like, you're like, do I really have this?
Yeah.
Then bam, something happens. And like, okay, I got it. All right, getting hard to swallow. Everyone's telling me I need to speak up when I speak, things like that. But all in all, in general, I feel great. And, you know, I progress relatively slow, which is a good thing.
Your kids, and obviously we always, I mean, I've got 3 daughters, and I think all the time about them. How are they doing with this, and how do you educate them, prepare them, talk with them about it, or do you guys not talk about it?
We really don't talk about it unless they see something they haven't seen before and be like, Dad, why are you doing that? And I go, it's just what comes with it. This happens.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, really for them, you know, to be all honest, the thing that they've dealt with more so than anything is just my bouts of depression.
Yeah.
Because my mind always wants to get depressed because of the chemical change. And so that's been pretty tough, you know, not just on them, but for me as well. But, I mean, they notice it. They recognize it. They feel like they got to get me up off the couch or out the house. They do it. You know, they're my caregivers. Love them.
Brian Grant with us. Had a stint with the Blazers that everybody remembers in the NBA. Also played for the Sacramento Kings, the Heat, the Lakers, and the Suns. You got a kid. I was in the Oregon State locker room, and I look up and I see, you know, your kid's name on one of the locker stalls, Jaden Grant. And I thought, you know, you must be awfully proud of that kid being in that locker room and trying to play college football.
Let me tell you something. I didn't even know he could play football. I didn't know he was could play it as well as he does. It was actually Houston Lillard, Dame Lillard's older brother.
Yeah.
Sat me down just talking because asked me if he could send Jaden's tape out, and I said, on what, basketball? I said, no, football. I said, sure. So he got a few visits. We went out, and at first he had committed to Oregon, and then he thought about it and then committed to Oregon State. And so I just really didn't know, because I don't follow football like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's good or what's not good. But I tell you, when I got down there and I started seeing him in them scrimmages, I could tell that he had a knack for the ball, meaning, you know,
yeah,
that last play that they had on TV down there in their spring ball, I thought he was beat. I was like, oh, quarterback solid. There's a great pass by the quarterback. Just at the last second, he just timed it and got up in there and grabbed it. And I was just going crazy with my friends. Like, man, dang, he got to it.
Yeah.
So I'm very proud of him. I'm very proud of him. You know, this is his thing. I, when I'm down there, I don't talk basketball. I only talk football.
Yeah. That's a cool thing to do, to follow your kid. I will see you down there at the stadium. I love having you on. I love your perspective on life and fatherhood and the NBA, Brian. And we'll have to get you fishing with Thomas Tyner. I'll connect that for you.
Hook it up.
All right. Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
You bet. That's Brian Grant, a former NBA player. Parents, you know you can relate with that. He's talking about being proud of seeing his kid do something that, you know, he had no interest in playing football. He played high school basketball and then went to college at Xavier. In the 1994 draft, he's the 8th pick overall in the first round, and you know why now. you know, the backstory on him working out. But, you know, he's playing basketball and he was second all time on Xavier's scoring list. He was the Midwest Collegiate Conference Player of the Year twice. All 4 years at Xavier, he led Xavier in rebounding. And he made honorable mention All-American his junior year. That was it. Honorable mention All-American. He's picked eighth overall by the Kings. Starts 59 games his rookie year. Averages 7.5 rebounds. Second season in the NBA, he starts 75 games. And you know, he's rewarded with 5 years, $29 million. The Blazers in 1997, 20 years ago, signed Brian Grant to a six-year, $56 million deal. He's the last splashy, high-profile free agent to choose Portland. Don't give me Evan Turner. Not splashy. Fallback. Don't give me, don't bring up any of those guys. And I don't want Hedo Turkoglu signed an offer sheet. I don't want, he made a visit. I don't want, you know, Roy Hibbert was about to go to the airport. The Blazers, it's not a June swoon. It's more like July is a bad month for the city of Portland NBA fans. Brian Grant, 20 years ago, picked Portland. Since then, they've had to overpay to get marginal talent to come here in free agency. He told you why. Look outside. It's all guys see all year long. And I think it's part of why basketball in Portland has worked. It is simultaneously the worst thing that could happen to Portland because during the basketball season, the weather sucks. It's all the players see. It's all the visiting players. More importantly, the potential free agents, it's all they see. They see bad weather. That's why the basketball, it, you know, it's not three avenues that are available to the Blazers. It's not draft, trade, and free agency. It's just draft and trade. Free agents are not coming here for the reasons Brian Grant laid out. You're not going to tell, you know, a free agent, hey, it's great schools. That's not what they're interested in. But so the bottom line is, simultaneously, it's the thing that holds Portland back. It's also why the reason I think basketball is big here, it's not just because it's the only thing we have, OGIT, O-G-I-T, only game in town. It's not just that. It's that the weather's bad, it's dreary outside, it's dark, and what do? We go inside, we go to an NBA arena, it's bright inside, people are cheering, everybody's happy, we come together. When it's crappy outside, we go inside. So in part, I think that's why it works here. But credit to Brian Grant, father of seven, including Jaden Grant, who's at Oregon State as a defensive back, for the work he's done, not just as a basketball player, but as a person, raising awareness and raising money for a lot of different causes, including Parkinson's research. And he was diagnosed in November 2008. It's been 9 years, and you heard him talk about it today. If you missed any of that interview, you can grab a podcast of that at SoundCloud or iTunes.
Want more of the best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show? Leave it right here. Here's John Canzano with the Bald-Faced Truth.
Well, I want you to know that I do not take you for granted as a listener. You're an absolute army. The listeners of this radio show across the state of Oregon, absolute army. I appreciate you and you can shoot feedback to me at John Canzano BFT. Tell us the guests that you want to hear. There's going to be a lot to talk about with the Trailblazers this summer, and including the next few days. Hope you've enjoyed all the basketball interviews today, from Sam Bowie to Damon Stoudemire to Brian Grant. Got a treat for you here as we go through the best of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show. Gary Trent, a polarizing figure in Blazers history. A lot of Blazer fans remember Gary Trent as a tough guy. Well, we're going to catch up here with Gary Trent in just a couple of minutes. You're going to find out what he's doing now. Just a quick reminder for those of you listening to this show that you can subscribe to the Bald-Faced Truth radio show on SoundCloud and iTunes. I want to give a shout out not just to the listeners in Portland, but to those listening on Fox Sports Eugene, 95.7 FM. Shout out to you guys in 1050 AM. Also to our listeners to be in Klamath Falls, Klamath Falls about to become affiliate number two on the Bald Faced Truth Radio Network. So I want to thank all the listeners in Klamath Falls who have reached out and said, hey, we want the BFT radio show. We want some local radio, too. For those of you who follow me on Twitter already, you know that I will break news there. I will give analysis. I will talk about the Blazers as this draft day comes and goes. And we'll have all the coverage right here on this radio station. So make sure that you leave it locked in here and you'll get all the updates as they come. Yes, it's been a basketball day. And yes, basketball is important to the city of Portland. But we've done some of the great interviews. And if you missed Sam Bowie earlier, or you missed Damon Stoudemire or Brian Grant, by all means, grab a podcast of this show. But leave it locked in for this one. Gary Trent. Whatever happened to Gary Trent? Well, you won't believe that he ended up at a school. Here's that interview with Gary Trent.
You're listening to the best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.
Dayton's Bluff Elementary Schools in St. Paul, Minnesota, and Gary Trent is joining us. Are you still an assistant principal there?
Yes, sir.
Assistant Principal Gary Trent. How does that strike you?
Well, you know, I never really thought that it would work out like that later on. But, you know, a lot of times when you're in the midst of your career, you know, only thing you can think of is basketball, basketball, basketball. So, you know, my main title is intervention specialist. You know, that's what my role is at the school. I'm assistant to the principal. And basically when he's gone, I'm acting principal. And a lot of the duties, you know, when he's got things going on, they fall into my lap, which is some good training for me to get an understanding for the school system and children as a whole, you know.
You're a no-nonsense guy as a player, 10 NBA seasons in Portland, Minnesota, Dallas, and Toronto. Are you a no-nonsense principal?
Yes, got to be, you know, because these kids down here nowadays, they just need way more guidance and way more nurturing. So it's great for them. And the best thing about it, I work at a sixth grade and under school, so the kids have taken to me and they bond to me and they respond to me. And they've taken a liking to me, not because I'm Gary Trent, a basketball player. You know, I left the Wolves in 04, so probably those kids, my oldest student, would probably have been 3 or 4 at the time. So they wouldn't have known of Gary Trent, a basketball player. They discovered that as I've worked in the building. But I was glad I built a relationship with them from the professional standpoint of what I was hired to do before they took a liking to me due to Gary Trent, the basketball player.
You grew up in a neighborhood in Columbus, Ohio, known as the Jungle. How did your own upbringing lead you to where you are now?
Well, a lot of these kids are going through a lot of the same situations I went through as a kid. It would amaze you how many kids you talk to who went in single parent home or, you know, parents are on drugs or both parents are on drugs. There's domestic violence going on in every kid's home. I mean, the school that I'm at is a great school. You know, we're an Achievement Plus school. We have reading specialists in the building every day, speech therapists in the building every day, math specialists, any subject that has to do with education. We have at least one or two people in the school building to help them children with that. Just pull them out of class, you know, 20 minutes a day on the side just to help them get ahead in their math or reading or to catch up on whatever they're at. And it's just great for them kids, and they need that.
You were part of the Blazers team 95 to 98. What do you remember about your time in Portland?
You know, it was the greatest time for me due to the fact it was my first team. And we had a lot of young guys on the team. You know, you had Don Wingfield, you know, Rasheed Wallace, Jermaine O'Neal, myself, Aaron McKee. It was just a great time, and I was learning a lot. You know, we had some great veterans, you know, Cliff Robinson, Ron Strickland, Sabonis. So it was just a great time. You know, I had young guys that I could bond with, but I also had veterans. You know, Buck Williams was probably one of the greatest veterans because, you know, in college, you know, your biggest gap will be a freshman and possibly a fifth-year senior. But it's different when I'm a 20-year-old kid that just turned 21 and Buck Williams is 35, 36. So there's a 15-year gap as far as basketball, but there's also a 15-year gap as a man. You know, I was at his age, I was young enough to be his child, so you know, he was a very wise veteran, and it was good to, you know, be a part of that, you know.
You know, that locker room was a tough locker room as well, but you were were you comfortable in that locker room?
Very comfortable. I had no problems with nobody, you know. All my seasons, I never had any problems with any teammate. You know, I was probably a guy on every team. I could deal with, I could hang out with a J.R. Ryder, or I could also hang out with a Mark Madsen, you know, who was a Mormon and very religious, and, you know, or Chris Dudley, you know, so I could associate with anybody. You know, one road trip, I might go to dinner with Chris Dudley. One dinner trip, one road trip, I might go with Anna McKee and Cliff. I mean, it varies, road trip to road trip.
Gary Trent, our guest, former NBA player, now an assistant principal and a cultural intervention specialist at a elementary school in St. Paul, Minnesota. Joining us here on 750 The Game. Sabonis, you mentioned Sabonis. For those who never got to see him every day in a practice, how good was he?
Sabonis, by the time he came to the NBA, we only saw the tail end of what he really was. You know, at one point in time in his career, this guy would face players up, put the ball on the floor, spin moves, you know, shoot the three. You know, by the time he came to us, it was, you know, four or five knee surgeries later, a couple of Achilles surgeries later, and he was still very effective. He still had great touch. He still had great wisdom for the game. You know, one of the greatest passers to play at that point in time. But had we seen him maybe 5 to 8 years before he came to the Blazers, you know, Sabonis would have been probably a starter in the All-Star game year after year.
Gary Trent, our guest here on 750 The Game. A typical day as an intervention specialist, what do you do? Are you just interacting with kids, counseling kids, talking with kids, or how in the classroom are you?
I'm all of that. You know, I go and sit in classrooms. You know, it's not just all about being on the kids. You know, there's a responsive classroom format that the teachers have to follow before a kid gets put out of the classroom. So I have to make sure that the teachers are following that protocol. And I also have to make sure what the kids are doing. You know, I'm interacting with parents daily, calling parents, communicating with parents, you know, being part of the community, seeing what's going on with the staff in the office. You know, I'm almost like the glue of the school. You know, I'm involved in everything. Just to try to keep everything going. You know, I do lunch duty. I do after-school duty. I do the duty that I'm supposed to do during the day. You know, if the principal has to go downtown for a meeting, then if there's a parent meeting, I'm acting principal. So it's a great situation, and I love it because it's something that I'm still learning. And at my age, you know, not too many things that people get involved in at 37 were still new to them. They're still learning and still growing. So to me, it's exciting because I'm doing something that's totally new. So it's exciting to me.
You know, it's neat, too, because, you know, I, as a newspaper columnist, I'll do a lot of stories about the cycle of families in generations. And, you know, you grew up in a family in a tough neighborhood. Your parents and several other relatives, correct me if I'm wrong, served jail time. Drugs were involved.
Drugs, murder, bank robbery, kidnapping, the whole nine. You know, my family had a thing going, I call it generational dysfunction, where every generation just keeps falling into the pitfalls and just getting sucked into all the negativity and just sucked in all the wrong routes. And, you know, I have ability within my household to break that cycle of generational dysfunction. And a lot of these kids that are at the school are going through generational dysfunction due to grandparents passing it down. And, you know, and I hope a lot of these kids, you're not going to be able to save them all. But the few that want to change and the few that want to be saved, you know, they're easier to reach and they're easier to work with. And there's some more difficult kids who have no belief in their future and no belief in their life. And just home is such a wreck. They never met their father, and, you know, some mothers are in prison. So it's all those kids need to be reached out to and not really given up on. You know, you don't give up on any of those children, you know, and even the more difficult cases. But, you know, everyone will not be saved.
You know, but you broke that cycle, that generational cycle. What was it? Was it basketball? Was it people around you? Was it a decision by you that said, you know what, I don't want that life? What was it?
It was the opportunity to play basketball that surrounded me with a few good people that started at my high school. You know, my high school coach, my high school superintendent, and a few people within the building, you know, just kind of took me up under their wing and kind of helped me throughout life and helped me do some of my trying times and some of my frustrated times and was just there for me and gave me some guidance of what the next steps were in life, you know. Now, at my age group that I'm dealing with, at sixth grade and under, I'm dealing with a lot of different issues. Nowadays at the high school, you're probably dealing with, you know, a lot of kids and teenage pregnancies and things of that nature. I'm still dealing with more kiddie issues, but this is the point to where they're the best to try to turn them around. I'd say probably about eighth grade and under. You know, once kids get to ninth grade in high school and they, you know, doing their own thing, and they've already been delinquent at home for so many years, it's harder to pull them back in. Right now, these kids aren't so far out in the water, so they still have their feet on the ground due to their age, so they're easier to be reached and they're easier to pull back in, you know?
Gary Trent, our guest, played in 28 NBA postseason games with Portland and Minnesota, 506 NBA games in his career. In college, you were known as the Shaq of the MAC, player of the year all three seasons, the only player in history of the Mid-American Conference to get that. Do the kids call you the Shaq of the MAC?
Nah, some of the kids discovered it because Google, and they look it up, and then some kids come and tell me they play with me on NBA Live and 2K and video games and things of that nature. So it's exciting. I think it's exciting for them when they come back to school the next day, because you can always see their face glowing when they're ready to tell you something.
And they've got to be able to get on Google, so you do have to answer questions. So they ask you about the pool cue and the bar fight?
They've asked me a few little questions about some of my incidents, you know, and I tell them the truth, you know. Whatever the situation may be, and, you know, it was a bad decision, and if it happened to me now, here's how I would handle it, you know, because there's a situation of how you handle it when it happened, but then there's also the response of a person who's grown and who's mature, and you would say, now, if I could do it all over again, here's how I would have handled it now. So, you know, things like that happen, and, you know, like I explained to these kids, where y'all live at, there's sometimes trouble is going to be 100% avoidable. You can walk away from a situation. You can ignore a situation. Somebody might chase you down. Somebody might chase you home. You know, protect yourself. But for the most part, a lot of these situations that you end up in, they can be avoided.
The guy threw a drink in your face. I think people understand why you would why you'd go after him.
Well, to throw a drink in my face because I won't speak to you, that's, you know, that's unacceptable by my standards. So, you know, at that point in time, I felt I did what I had to do. And most of it was a restraining. Most of it was just a restraining type of situation. But, you know, when he wouldn't calm down because he was too liquor charged, you know, you have to do what you have to do to try to de-escalate the situation and then just get off the scene.
Gary Trent, our guest, former Blazer, also now working as a cultural intervention specialist, assistant principal at Dayton's Bluff Elementary in East St. Paul, Minnesota, doing a great job with kids. Your career, what do you remember most, and what do you take away as the highlight of your playing career?
The highlight of my playing career was my career. Being able to just fulfill a dream like that, you know, there's probably 20 million people that want to play NBA basketball, and there's only 60 people that get the opportunity every year, and about 400 guys that get to do it yearly. So just every day of practice, every game, every training camp, even my off-season preparation, I loved it because I was getting the opportunity to do something that so many people dream of, so many people wish, so many people pray for, so many people try to, and they don't get that opportunity. So to me, my highlight was the opportunity to be able to have that career.
Gary Trent, our guest here, when you talk about, you know, a lot of guys in your position will come back and be assistant coaches that want to stay around the game. Why do you choose to help kids and not stay around the game?
Well, you know, I have three sons. And, you know, as I've coached all my son's teams over the years, I've been around kids. I've had kids, you know, who's in bad situations where, you know, we've got tournaments this weekend, and I know if they don't spend the night at my house Friday, they won't make that 9 o'clock game on Saturday morning. So, you know, a lot of times I just spent so much time around kids because my son is 13 now. So I've just spent so many times around kids that the job was a perfect fit now. But on the flip side of that, I do want to be a college coach, and I would love to be an NBA assistant or a player development coach because that's what I do now as a side profession. I do player development for my team, and I do player development outside of my team. I'm probably one of the few coaches that actually develops his own players because if you look at a high school team, most players hire their parents, hire some outside source, or they hire somebody outside of the team. Not too many head coaches do their own player development. You know, I've done some high schools back in Columbus a few years back. So, you know, I love to take a player who has no footwork, has no moves, but a great athlete and develop him and then watch him grow and then watch him use those moves in the games and succeed. And you see the kids' face light up and the joy light up and the confidence now that they have these moves in their arsenal and now that they can drop step or now that they can spin move. it's great to watch these kids go from zero to what I produce them to be.
You have a reputation as a player. I mean, you're a big guy. You were very no-nonsense. You would confront people one-on-one, and you were a tough guy. And yet, when you talk, you're extremely articulate, intelligent. You've got a great brain. You're interested in kids and in helping kids find the right direction. Does that surprise people? Do you get people who go, man, Gary, I didn't know you had that in you?
You know, a lot of times when my friends watch my interview, they'd be like, who is that on right now on TV? So it's funny, you know, but it's almost like an NFL lineman. You know, people see these guys, they're rough and tough and snatching helmets and whatnot, but my basketball demeanor and the way I played basketball, yeah, that's part of my personality, but there's also a different side to me that I don't have to be tough. I don't have to draw a line in the sand and you can't cross this line, and I don't have to be a hard-edged person. That was my play. That was my basketball personality, and if you cross that line during that game, I'm going to address you during the game, but a lot of times during the game, that's all for show, people talking trash, you're on TV. You know, now after the game, or I see you at a local restaurant, are you going to have that same attitude? No, I don't think so. So a lot of times I knew them other guys was just a bunch of facades. So to me, don't play with me like that out here because this is my job. And don't play with me like that out here because you're not built like that to carry yourself like that. Because if you're going to carry that image, when I see you, make sure that you still got that image. Don't see me now and want to buy dinner, you know?
J.R. Ryder, do you still stay in contact?
I haven't talked to J.R. in a couple of years. I talked to him a few years ago. You know, he's had some ups and downs, and I happened to, through a mutual friend, end up passing him my number, and he just called me out the blue one day, and we talked about 3 days in a row, about 4 hours each day. So it was good to hear his voice and just to talk to some of the things he's been through in life and some of the things I've been through in life, because what a lot of these young NBA players aren't prepared for, what are you going to do one day when there is no more air in your ball?
Gary Trent, great stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Best of the Bald-Faced Truth Radio Show.